Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I work for the Western Shoshone Defense Project, which is a Western Shoshone-directed organization that was created by the Western Shoshone National Council back in the early 90s, at first specifically to assist the efforts of Western Shoshone elders Mary and Carrie Dan and their family, the Dan family, in their efforts to advance and protect Western Shoshone land rights. Since that time, we've worked on issues outside of just the Dan issue, issues affecting Shoshone country in general and Shoshone land rights. So I've had the opportunity for the past 10 years to be working on these issues and working out here. There's been a lot of things that have been happening in Shoshone country over the past 12 months and a lot more over the past 150 years. And it's all related, and you can't really understand what's happening now without understanding what's been going on for the past 150 years. And seeing as how I'm a history buff, I'll give everyone a brief history lesson here as I've been come to understand it from listening to people and doing research. How many of you are familiar with the Treaty of Ruby Valley or the Treaty of Peace and Friendship? So fairly familiar with that. How about the Indian Claims Commission? Anybody know anything about the Indian Claims Commission? A little bit about that. Did anybody hear that the U.S. Just this last January was found after an extensive 10-year investigation by an international human rights body was found to have grossly violated the rights of the Western Shoshone people? Anybody heard that? Well, it's good. There's a couple people, but not many, and that's part of the problem is that there's been gross injustice going on for decades now. And unfortunately, the mainstream media and press hasn't picked it up, or there's been every effort to spin it in certain directions so people don't understand kind of what the underlying causes and effects of what's happening out here. So we had this treaty, Treaty of Peace and Friendship, between two nations, Western Shoshone Nation and my nation, which I reluctantly admit, the United States. The treaty was essentially an agreement to share. Understand, though, of course, this treaty was done at gunpoint, that there was a terror campaign by the United States through the California Volunteers, which was the name of the cavalry group that was sent out to Shoshone country to secure Shoshone country, primarily for mineral interests. So that treaty was signed at gunpoint, but nonetheless, it's important because it was an official recognition by the U.S. government that there was indeed a Western Shoshone Nation. And in that treaty, they also recognized the boundaries of that Western Shoshone Nation. And the Shoshone Nation, the Western Shoshone Nation, extended all the way from, and continues to extend from, the Snake River in southern Idaho, all the way down south of here through Death Valley and portions of the Mojave Desert. Where we have the Timbisha Shoshone people down in this neck of the woods, or desert, as the case may be. The treaty was treaty to share. Shoshone people said, okay, with the gun at their head, you can build a railroad through our land. You can put a telegraph through our land. You can bring a stagecoach through our land, and we're not going to stop you. You can even mine on our land and set up ranches to feed those miners. And you can cut timber to provide for those ranches and those miners. Well, since that time, unfortunately, the U.S. has come to believe that they no longer need to share anymore. And so you have a situation where the original people who in a solemn and legally binding international document in that treaty agreed to share their land are faced with the United States that is telling people, you no longer have any land. It's not yours anymore. And we have no legal requirement to share it with you. If you'd like to use this land, perhaps you could pay us and get a permit to use it like everybody else, but it's not your land anymore. And they justify that basically through the proceedings of the Indian Claims Commission. And the Claims Commission was set up in the late 1940s, around 1946, ostensibly to provide some measure of justice to Indian people that had their lands illegally taken away from them at some point in the past. Unfortunately, if you look back at what the Indian Claims Commission actually did, it becomes apparent that it was more interested in clearing title to land than it was in doing any justice. In other words, they wanted to make it clear that these lands were no longer Indian lands, and they did that by paying the Indians for those lands at a value at some point in the past. The lawyers who wrote the Indian Claims Commission Act came out of Utah. And those same very firm that wrote the act immediately fanned out into Indian country across the West to start soliciting claims. Because under the Indian Claims Commission Act, the only thing the Claims Commission can do is pay you for land that you've lost. And it even sets it up so that the lawyers representing the tribe would get 10% of the total value of whatever was compensated to the Indian people. And to make matters even worse, the lawyers didn't have to be working with any particular representative government or body from the Indians that were making the claim. So in other words, they could go out to Indian country and get a couple Indians together and have them make a claim on behalf of their whole nation, which is exactly what they did. You didn't have to have the tribal government making the claim. You didn't have to have the traditional government making the claim. Apparently, it didn't really matter who made the claim. The important thing was that the claim was made. So through this process, they had a series. And another interesting thing about the Claims Commission is, as far as I know, there were very few Indian people that actually ever even testified or spoke before the Indian Claims Commission. It was all either white lawyers or expert witnesses, the anthropologists, because they all know better. And so they immediately started this process in Shoshone country in the late 40s, early 1950s. And the way it's been described to me by various people is that many Shoshone people at the start of the process thought that the lawyers were arguing for their treaty rights, because they understood that there was still a legally binding treaty in place there. And the lawyers, for their part, certainly didn't try to dissuade people from believing that, because they needed at least some sort of people to say that they were making the claim for. So they started the process, and it went on for decades. Part of the reason it went on so long was that they couldn't find anything that happened that would legally have transferred title of the land from the Western Shoshone Nation over to the United States. There was no official war. There was no official surrender. Unlike a lot of treaties with Indian people, which were treaties of cession, where Indian people were agreeing to give up a portion of their land to retain a part, this treaty was a peace and friendship, and it granted certain rights to white people, but it didn't give up anything for Shoshone people. So they couldn't come up with a date. So how could you pay the Indians if you can't figure out when you actually took the land? And everybody assumed, all the white people assumed, that, well, obviously they'd lost the land. So they came up with a date. The lawyers representing the Western Shoshone and the lawyers representing the U.S. basically entered into a gentleman's agreement, so to speak, and said, well, we can't really figure out what exactly happened that got us the land, but we know it's ours, so we're going to come up with a date. And they came up with July 1st, 1872. And that's going to be the date we're going to say that you lost the land on. And therefore, we'll pay you for the land as it was valued in 1872. And again, nothing happened on, you know, what happened on July 1st, 1872? It was probably a hot day in the desert. And that was probably about it, because there wasn't much else going on. In 1872, the majority of Western Shoshone country was still unoccupied by white people. There were mining towns set up. There were enclaves of white people that occupied a very tiny portion of Shoshone territory. But for the most part, it was still unoccupied. Well, they said gradual encroachment. In 1872, the Shoshone people had lost title to all of their land. And we're talking, the figure that they used was 26 over 24 million acres. And actually, the actual territory is actually far greater than that. It's probably 40 to 60 million acres. But the number they were compensated for was around 24 million acres. And they said, you lost it all because of gradual encroachment by white settlers and others. And, of course, we've never quite figured out who the others were, but it was white settlers and others. And so that was the premise that they used. And they said, well, you lost your land at some point in the past. We can't say exactly when, but it was because white people came onto the land. Now, remember, under the treaty granted white people the right to come and set up their ranches. It granted them the right to create these mining towns. But now the government, 100 years later, is saying those actions made you lose title to the land, even though those were accepted actions under the treaty. So people started to realize what was going on, and there were various attempts by Western Shoshone tribal governments, traditional leadership, and organizations to intervene in that claims process. And every time Shoshone people of one form or another, one entity or another, came to that commission and said, this is all wrong. This is not the way it happened. The commission refused their rights to intervene and said, no, we're not listening to you. You don't have a right to speak here. Well, finally, it came all the way up to the 70s, and at which point in time you actually had a federally recognized tribal government that was the client of the lawyers advancing the claim. And again, like I said, through these decades, from the late 40s all the way to the early 70s, this claims process was going on. And there was never a single Shoshone entity that was part of it. There would be people that would be involved, and then they would fall away, and the lawyers would go and find a different group of people and keep advancing the claim. Well, come the 70s, the Timok Tribal Council, in their wisdom, said, no, this is ridiculous. This is not what we want. We're firing the lawyer. And they fired the lawyer and hired a new one to argue for their continuing rights under the treaty, rights to their Aboriginal homelands. Well, the U.S. government said, you can't do that. We don't recognize your new attorney, and we are going to finish the process with your old attorney, because this process has gone far too long and too far for you to be firing the attorney and ending it right now. And this all comes back to the fact that under U.S. law, Indian people are wards of the state. We want to be able to take care of ourselves, and we need the land to do that. But, you know, apparently that's too much to ask for, you know, and that's a pretty sad state of affairs. So anyways, getting nowhere in the courts, the Dans went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they said, the BLM's got no right to come and tell us that we're trespassing, you know, because of everything I just told you. And the Supreme Court said, you've been paid for your land. And because you've been paid for the land, this other law says you can't talk about it anymore. So you're out of luck. And now the BLM throws that in our face and say, you've been paid for your land, and you all went to the Supreme Court. You had your day in court. So they're so bald-faced, they go, you've had your day in court. You went to court, even though you never even got to argue anything in court, because all the court looked at was if you've been paid or not. And if you've been paid, they don't have to talk about it. So they found you'd been paid, and you don't have to talk about it. Well, so we went to the international community because it was obvious that the U.S. courts weren't capable of doing justice on this matter. So in 1992, working with a nonprofit Indian law firm out of Montana, the Indian Law Resource Center, the Dan family, the Dan sisters, made a formal complaint before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Now, this Inter-American Commission, it was set up by the Organization of American States. Now, again, remember, the U.S. helped set up the Organization of American States. It's essentially a UN-like organization for North, Central, and South America. And the U.S. was a big supporter of the Inter-American Commission when it was first set up, because the Inter-American Commission did a lot of work on human rights issues in Central and South America, particularly concerning the death squads and stuff like that was happening. So the U.S. was happy of the Inter-American Commission to do that work down there because it supported the U.S.'s political agenda. Well, the Inter-American Commission, for the last 10 years, investigated the case brought forth by the Dans. During that 10-year period, the U.S. was filing its own submissions and saying, this is not a human rights issue, this is taken care of, they've had their day in court, Inter-American Commission, butt out, it's taken care of. Well, the Inter-American Commission, did a really good job and actually deserves a lot of credit for standing up, because they made an initial report last fall, and the report was made permanent in January. And what they found is that they said that the U.S. has clearly violated the human rights of the Dan sisters and other Western Shoshone people. And in particular, they have violated their right to property. They have violated their rights to due process. And they have violated their rights to equality before the law. And this is very significant because the Inter-American Commission looked at the Indian Claims Commission process. Because the U.S. is claiming that that was a legal process, that was a court, and therefore they got their day in court because they went through the Claims Commission process. Well, the Inter-American Commission looked at the Claims Commission process and saw it for what it was, which was basically a kangaroo court designed to pay off the Indians in clear title and not providing them the kind of due process and equality before the law that any other U.S. citizen would have in a case of property or takings. And so what has been the U.S.'s response? This was January. The report was made final. In February, they came in on the armed raid to take the horses again. And the U.S.'s position has been they don't care what the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights says, that the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights has no jurisdiction over the U.S., and the U.S. has no legal obligation to listen to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And that's the answer that we've gotten, and then they're continuing to pay this money out and get this money paid out. So it's discouraging, to say the least, but it's becoming more blatant. And I think what we're seeing, or at least what I was thinking when we were dealing with all the feds in rounding up the animals the other month, was that what we are seeing there in Crescent Valley on a very local level is merely a local reflection of a U.S. policy that is being conducted on an international level. And that is that the U.S. does not find itself subject to anybody's opinion or regulation, will clearly ignore international law when it's against the interests of the administration, and will, baldly invoke international law when it does advance the interests of the current regime. So, where do we go from here? Again, I want to encourage you to contact your congresspeople about the Western Shoshone Claims Distribution Act. It is very important that we defeat this now. And not that people don't deserve some sort of monetary compensation for the damage and crimes that have been done, but it can't be in exchange for the people's future generations' rights to use and occupy their lands and practice their culture like has been done for thousands of years. They tried to pull a fast, and just a little bit more, I know I'm going on too long, but last year they promoted these bills. And again, okay, who's promoting these bills? Well, there's a self-appointed group of Western Shoshone called the Western Shoshone Claims Steering Committee. They're promoting the distribution. But Senator Harry Reid, Mr. Environmental Harry Reid, has been at the forefront of pushing this bill forward and has taken a lot of political heat because of it. So what does Mr. Reid have to gain from getting Shoshone people their money? Because there aren't, population-wise, Indian people in the state represent maybe 1% of the state population. You don't have big Indian gaming in the state, so you don't see a lot of money coming from Indian communities going to political campaigns. So you got to start to ask, who's Reid doing this for? What does he have to gain from it? And how do you do that? Well, you follow the money. Okay? Follow the money. Who's the big money out here? Well, let's look at the corporations. The first one I can think of is Bechtel. Okay? Bechtel. Bechtel runs the Nevada test site. Bechtel built the Hoover Dam. Bechtel built some of the largest gold mines in the northern part of the state. Bechtel's going to run the anti-terrorism center. Bechtel might build Yucca Mountain. Bechtel's getting a lot of contracts in Iraq right now. Bechtel's a privately owned company, very hard to get information on, but very powerful. Donates to Senator Reid's campaign, donates to Senator Reid's Harry Reid Environmental Center at UNLV, you know, right there. Okay, let's follow some more money. Well, what are the two biggest industries in the state? Number one's gambling. What's number two? Mining, exactly. So, you know, look at the campaign donations. Senator Reid has been the number one Democratic defender of the mining industry in the country. He gets big bucks from campaign donations. Big defender, has basically single-handedly helped prevent the modification of the 1872 mining law. The main federal law that regulates mining out here was written in 1872. Hasn't been significantly modified to that date. Congress Representative Gibbons from Nevada here, Republican, again, big supporter of mining, big supporter of national security and the test site. So, I mean, what we're seeing is a conspiracy of interests, that there are a lot of very powerful entities that have a lot to gain by continuing to exploit and use Western Shoshone land. And unfortunately, in the current state of our political system represents their interests far more than it represents the interests of anybody else. And so we've got a tough nut to crack there. But one thing they don't like is exposure. So the more that we can document this, that we can demonstrate the connections. Now, another thing, geothermal, energy companies, big deal. Right now, Senator Bush, he says, oh, we have to develop more energy in the United States. So Senator Reid, the environmentalist, well, we need clean power like geothermal. Well, there's hot springs all across Shoshone country, and a lot of them happen to have a lot of cultural significance. So now, you know, they want to develop these hot springs. The last remaining free-flowing hot springs in Crescent Valley on Dan family traditional land are currently up for lease by the BLM. So you have all these very powerful interests that see a big bonanza in Shoshone land. You have a lot of people that want to privatize, that can't stand the fact that most of Nevada is so-called federal land, a lot of the local non-Indian population. They would like to see everything privatized. Well, you can't privatize or sell any of this land until you clear the title. Well, until Shoshone people are paid off, there's still a cloud over the title. Hence, the need to get that bill through and pay people off so they can say they were paid and they cashed the check. So they no longer have any say, because everybody knows in the back of their mind and in their heart that who really belongs to this land. I've talked long enough. I've got newsletters. We've gotten Amnesty involved. Amnesty International has finally seen the light and are starting to get more involved in indigenous issues, and have, in fact, started to look at the Western Shoshone issue and get involved. I have some Amnesty flyers that has information about the case on it. So that's encouraging. But I want to go back to what Catherine was saying earlier about trying to stay positive. And anybody who knows me is kind of laughing at the fact that I'm trying to tell people to stay positive, because I'm the biggest cynic there is. But we've had a lot of difficulties in the past 6 to 12 months. Is that there has been a real, you know, for lack of a better explanation, a real bad spirit that's gotten out of the bottle. And that people, organizations, and individuals who are allies, who have always worked together now, are not talking to each other. There's lots of miscommunication between people. It's really uncanny. I mean, there's always been that kind of thing in the movement, but over the past 6 to 12 months, there's been an enormous amount of infighting, of, you know, a time when it's most important that we all work together. Everybody's going in separate directions, and there's a lot of poison being thrown around by people. And I see this in Shoshone country, but I also see it in the movement, in various different movements. And I don't know how to explain it, but I want to recognize that it's there, and that we all need to try to stay very grounded, very much work from our hearts, and you know, and pray a lot, really, and try to stay positive, because if we focus on the negativity, it builds and it snowballs, and then you hand it off, and it is poison that you hand off to other people, and they build that poison, and they hand it off and pass it to other people. And so I just guess would end by saying that, you know, let's get that poison out and set it aside and try to move forward in a good fashion together, because we really need each other more now than ever, because it's a hard road out there right now. So I'll be back over by the door there. I've got newsletters, and I've got other literature. I've also got T-shirts for sale if anybody's interested. We only have like the sizes nobody buys, double extra larges. And one T-shirt we just got made that people might be interested in. It's got a picture of Mary and Carrie Dan on it, across the top it says Homeland Security, and across the bottom it says Fighting Terrorism Since 1492. So anyways, I appreciate your attention, and the more they say the truth will set you free, sometimes it seems like the truth will make you miserable or make you a prisoner. I mean, that's honestly the way, the more you know, the grimmer it gets. But knowledge is power, and the more we become informed and the more we use that information to act from our hearts, the stronger we are. So anyways, thank you.